Okay, the adult class is going to be discussing a number of different archaeological finds, beginning with an item called the Taylor's Prism. And so if you will, turn in your Old Testament, 2 Chronicles chapter 32. 2 Chronicles chapter 32. You'll remember that we, in our class last week, discussed Hezekiah's tunnel, which was excavated and helped the people of Jerusalem basically in two ways. The primary way is that the spring of Gihon that had water welling up outside of the city was diverted, so that water was not available to Sennacherib and his army. Secondly, the diversion of the water into or inside the walls of the city was a source of water, although the spring was not sufficient to be the sole source of water for the city of Jerusalem. It was a source of water for Jerusalem. And this allowed, at least in part, or helped, assisted in the city withstanding the siege of Sennacherib. And we talked a little bit about that from 2 Chronicles chapter 32 with regard to the actual reference. You'll notice in verse 30 of the text, this same Hezekiah stopped the water outlet of Upper Gihon and brought the water by a tunnel to the west side of the city of David. Hezekiah prospered in all his works. And just kind of go back very quickly to the actual diagram that we have up on, where we have the spring here outside the walls of the city, and then about 1,700 feet later, it exits in Siloam's pool. And that was in the lower part of the city, the western part of the city, behind the city walls. And but what is talked about in this particular account in 2 Chronicles, the 32nd chapter, is the siege itself and the posturing of King Sennacherib as a part of that. I want to read that very quickly. Not going to read all of the material here in the 32nd chapter, but I do want to read verses 10 through 15 and then drop down to verse 20 in just a moment. Read with me verses 10 following. I want you to notice again the posturing of the king and the boastfulness of the king as recorded in this text is very similar to the language that is found on this particular prism called the Taylor's Prism. And we'll talk about the prism itself in just a moment, but let's look at the account as found in the Bible first. Thus says Sennacherib, king of Assyria, and it may be Sennacherib, I'm not sure exactly. I think I was saying Sennacherib last week. I don't remember. Thus says Sennacherib, king of Assyria, in what do you trust that you remain under siege in Jerusalem? You notice that there was a siege upon the city, and that is, I think, key for us with regard to the corroboration we're going to see. Does not Hezekiah persuade you to give yourselves over to die by famine and by thirst, saying, the Lord our God will deliver us from the hand of the king of Assyria? Has not the same Hezekiah taken away his high places and his altars and commanded Judah and Jerusalem, saying, you shall worship before one altar and burn incense on it? Do you not know what I and my fathers have done to all the peoples of other lands? Were the gods of the nations of those lands in any way able to deliver their lands out of my hand? Who was there among all the gods of these nations, those nations that my father utterly destroyed, that could deliver his people from my hand, that your God should be able to deliver you from my hand? Now therefore do not let Hezekiah deceive you or persuade you like this, and do not believe him. For no god of any nation or kingdom was able to deliver his people from my hand or the hand of my fathers. How much less will your God deliver you from my hand? Great deal of boasting going on here. Now, again, what we're talking about in regard to utilizing these kinds of discoveries for corroboration is not that every detail of these discoveries is going to corroborate every detail of Scripture. There are going to be obvious contradictions because of the perspective, the point of view. You've heard history belongs to the victorious, the winners. And they're the ones that write the history books, and so they proclaim in their annals their victories and the means by. So it's an interesting thing, though, when you look at this, that there are some things that we can look at that corroborate the biblical account in some detail. Now, I do want you to also notice verses 20 through 23, we're told that King Hezekiah and the prophet Isaiah, the son of Amos, prayed and cried out to heaven. This was as a result of these proclamations of Sennacherib, and also letters that reviled the Lord God of Israel. So the Lord sent an angel who cut down every mighty man of valor, leader, and captain in the camp of the king of Assyria. So he returned shamefaced to his own land. Now, just a thing to keep in mind with regard to this is he laid siege to the city. And there is, within the biblical account, the boasting that the city is going to fall. And that there will be destruction, there will be famine, there will be thirst. The people will die because basically Hezekiah has put them inside this cage. And so he was going to be victorious in the siege, but we're told in the biblical account that he went back shamefaced to his own land. He had gone into the temple of his God, some of his own offspring struck him down with the sword there, and the Lord saved Hezekiah and the inhabitants of Jerusalem from the hand of Sennacherib, the king of Assyria, and from the hand of all the others, and guided them on every side. And then he brought gifts to the Lord of Jerusalem, presents to Hezekiah, king of Judah, so he was exalted in the sight of all the nations thereafter. So, the things that we know with regard to this is that Sennacherib laid siege upon the city of Jerusalem. And after a period of time, he went back home, and he did not take the city. Well, the Tabor prison is actually a prism that is one of three that have been discovered, uncovered, that basically were all inscribed at about the same time. They think that two of the prisms were inscribed at exactly the same time, and the third about 18 months following. But they're located in three different locations. There is the one's called the Sennacherib prism, and the other one, the Jerusalem prism. The Sennacherib prism, I think, is located in, it's called the Oriental Museum, and I forget exactly what country it is, but the Jerusalem prism is in Jerusalem. The Sennacherib prism, all three of the prisms were discovered in Nineveh, but this one was discovered in Nineveh in 1830 by Colonel Robert Taylor, and all three of the prisms are identical, or almost identical. The text is almost exactly the same in all three. It's like they wrote it on one, and then they copied on the other two. And the belief is, and they try to, the date seems to be within a year or two, but that it was inscribed about 690 B.C. Now this again is something that's corroborated in secular archaeology. In other words, this isn't just a bunch of Bible believers that are corroborating the time and the legitimacy of this particular prism. But I want you to note that the siege that we're talking about here is believed took place about 700 B.C., 701 B.C. So we're talking about the events that are depicted in the prism as being having occurred only about a decade before it was reported. Now, with regard to this particular prism, and here are some of the specifics about the prism itself. The first eight campaigns of King Sennacherib are actually inscribed upon it. Now, I've seen close-ups. I don't know, when you really, none of these are good to see close-ups. When you do a close-up, it makes absolutely no sense to me. This looks like a lot of inscription. But they've been able to actually translate these. But I want you to consider as well, because it's difficult. On some of these pictures that we had, I've been able to find something to show scale, but I wasn't with regard to this one. So we're talking about something about 15 inches high and about 5 inches wide, and it's a six-sided prism. So it's a small eye, relatively small eye. It's not some big monolith like it may look like there. It's a fairly small artifact that was found. But among the eight campaigns that are mentioned in the Taylor Prism, it details his third campaign in the chronological list is the actions that he took against Hezekiah of Judah. And again, there are distinctions. They don't, the details don't corroborate in every place what the Bible has to say. I'm not going to read all of it, but I do want to read one. I'm going to go ahead and just read the quote. Let's go ahead and go to the next slide. The quote with regard to Hezekiah that's found on the prism, and the complete text. I didn't write down, but I want to at least show you some of what he's saying. It says, "As for Hezekiah the Judahite, who did not submit to my yoke, 46 of his strong-walled cities, as well as the small towns in their area, which were without number, by leveling with battering rams and by bringing up siege engines and by attacking and storming on foot by mines, tunnels, and breaches, I besieged and took them. 200,150 people, great and small, male and female, horses, mules, asses, camels, cattle, and sheep without number. I brought away from them and counted as spoil. Hezekiah himself, like a caged bird, I shut up in Jerusalem, his royal city. I threw up earthworks against him. The one coming out of the city gate, I turned back to his misery. His cities which I had despoiled, I cut off from his land. And to Metidni, king of Ashdod, Paddy, king of Ekron, and Silab Baal, king of Gaza, I gave him. And thus I diminished his land." So that's not all of it, but you see kind of the boasting that's going on as to what happened. It's an interesting thing, and I did take the time to read the entirety the entirety of that one side of the prism which this is mentioned. And you see that kind of boasting, but in almost every circumstance, what you find is, in effect, ultimate victory. That the cities that were laid siege to were breached, the cities were destroyed, or the people completely subjugated. And it's interesting that as far as intent, that same intent is noted in the biblical account there in 2 Chronicles chapter 32. He was boasting that he was going to do the same to Jerusalem as he had done with the others. But what we do know, not only by what the Bible account says, but what is indicated by the testimony of Sennacherib himself, is that he laid siege to the city and exacted tribute, but did not take the city. Basically, he claims that he brought many tribute, made, in effect, Hezekiah a vassal, or subjugated him as and exercised his authority over him, but he did not kill the king. He did not destroy the city of Jerusalem as he had all of the other cities that are found in these campaigns. And so there is at least that. So we have a couple of things that are corroborated by the prism. Number one, the name of Hezekiah, as mentioned as the king of Judah at the time in which Sennacherib reigned, is corroborated, which is, of course, the biblical account is corroborated by the Tabor prism. Secondly, the details concerning this particular siege, at least that's corroborated, that it was not an utter destruction, but rather it was a siege where he laid siege and then he left Hezekiah. Again, when you look at the fact that he, verse 21, the king of Assyria returned shamefaced to his land. King Sennacherib is not going to write that in his annals of victory, certainly. So there's going to be a distinct difference because of the point of view with regard to the writing. But anyway, we have that particular quote. So when you look at that, the claims as found in 2 Chronicles 32 is that he boasted that Hezekiah would die, verse 11, that there would be no deliverance, that their God was ineffectual, and the ultimate destruction of the city, in verses 23 through 23, but in verses 20 through 23, we find that did not happen. And so in that way, the Tabor prism corroborates certain details of that particular context. Okay? So there is an archaeological discovery which corroborates at least the story as it is found, or the account as it's found in 2 Chronicles chapter 33 of Sennacherib's siege upon Jerusalem. Okay, questions, comments about that one? And we talked a lot about that because Hezekiah's tunnel was involved in that siege as well. But these are two things that corroborate the existence of the tunnel and also the siege of Jerusalem. All right? Everybody okay with that? All right, let us then go in our next part of the study is the Moabite stone. And I'm trying to remember what I did with that. Not sure what my booklet is. Someone read to me the bullet, if you will, for the Moabite stone. Someone do that.
Omri, king of Israel, his son Ahab, and the Moabite king Nisha are validated by the discovery of the Moabite stone in 1868.
Okay.
The passages are 1 Kings 16, 21 through 28, and then the one we read before.
Okay, all right. So basically what we're establishing here is the existence of Omri, the existence of Ahab. By the way, Ahab is not mentioned by name. He's referred to simply as the son of Omri. But we'll look at that in just a few moments. And then also, corroboration of the biblical account there, which references there in 2 Kings chapter 3, Misha, who is the king of Moab. So if you will, turn in your New Testaments to that text in 2 Kings, the third chapter. And we'll read that in just a few moments' time. Before we do that, just looking at trying to first kind of introduce the actual find most of these times, and then we'll talk a little bit about the significance of it. This particular stone that is referred to as the Moabite stone is also known as the Misha Stele. And what that term, stele or stele, means is an inscribed stone. That's the term that is used. And Misha, of course, has reference to the individual who is responsible for the inscription. This time, Misha is the king of Moab. Moab is the location of that kingdom. Is in modern-day Jordan, in that region. It was discovered by an Anglican missionary on this occasion in 1868 at the ancient site of Dibon in Moab. And there are some interesting things about this. It's kind of hard to tell, but you'll notice that there is a few ladder sections in this inscription. What you have most of the time when you're looking at these things are replicas. We're going to look at the stone, Pilate's stone or Pilate's inscription that's found in Caesarea Maritime in just a few moments. And if we get there, that's the last one on the list if we get that far. They actually have a replica that's out at the site. That's not where the stone is actually located, but the replica is out on the site. And you can, I actually saw it with my own eyes, that particular stone. It's just a replica of it. And this is a replica as well. In actuality, only the light-colored areas that are found here still are in existence. When it was discovered by this Anglican missionary, it was found, the reference is, in situ, which means in its place. When it was found, it was completely whole. But the only individual who saw it, the only European who saw it in whole was this particular missionary. Because after that was found, less than a year later, before they could come back and do their excavations and those kinds of things, it actually was smashed by some villagers. And as a result of the smashing of it, some of it ended up in the rubble. So what they have left are the fragments. Now, that's not to say that we don't have access to the entirety of the text, because shortly before the stone was actually smashed, they had done what was called a squeezing, which is basically wetting down paper and squeezing it into all of the fissures and all of the letters and such, and letting it dry and then peeling it off. And it's kind of interesting when you look at some of these archaeological discoveries, what happens. So what happens is they've done that, it's in place, and literally within minutes of the stone being smashed, this missionary and a few others came and they removed the paper from the stone and basically ran for their lives before the stone smashed. And later on, the stone was found and it was recovered, at least the parts that they have. and the remainder of the inscription is supplied through the squeezing. So it is accurate, although there are certain portions down at the very bottom of it that are not readable. Completely readable, letters missing, which makes the translation a little bit iffy. And the reason why that is of any significance is because there is a possibility at the bottom of the stone that there is an inscription concerning his retaking a portion of his kingdom, and a reference is made to the house of David. But because of the limitations of the vocabulary, if you're missing a word, it could mean something completely different. So some people think that it's a reference to the house of David. Some people think that it's the reference to the house of some other name. I forget what the name was, which would have been maybe possibly a local leader at that particular time. But if it is a reference to the house of David, which is not as sure as the references to Omri and Ahab, if it is a reference to the house of David, that is the very earliest extra-biblical reference to King David and his lineage or his house as the king of Judah and of course those kings that followed after him in his reign and in his life. So anyway, so that's kind of some of what goes on there. And again, I've got complete text. I'll just read you just a little portion of it, and then we'll look at the specific important part. The complete text is, I am Mesha, son of Chemosh Gad, king of Moab. Now, Chemosh was actually the Moabite god, so his father was named after him, Chemosh Gad. The Moab of Moab, the Dibonite, or Dibonite. My father reigned over Moab 30 years, and I have reigned after my father. And I built this sanctuary for Chemosh in Karcha, a sanctuary of salvation. For he saved me from all aggressors and made me look upon all my enemies with contempt. So it's kind of a similar type of thing. Here is a king that is making a proclamation of how wonderful he is and how he's blessed by his God. But the events are found here in 2 Kings, the third chapter. I want you to notice a couple of things that are found in 2 Kings chapter 3. And then we'll look at a little bit more at the actual quote that this surrounds the account here. We already read, Josh read in verses 4 through 8. You'll notice that it was when Ahab died, verse 5, that Ahab died. Now, Ahab's father was Omri. And you can refer back with regard to Omri, the house of Omri, that he was the king of Israel. Then Ahab was his son. And then you'll notice the statement made in verse 6, that Jehoram was the king who followed after Ahab. So he went out from Samaria, mustered all of Israel, because Moab, the king, had rebelled against him. Well, that was Mesha, the king of Moab, that was rebelling. What happened was, as indicated by the text, and indicated in the quotation itself, is that that God, that Chemosh, that God, was displeased with his father, and for a period of time, he was subjugated by the house of Omri. But after he appeased Chemosh, that he was able to, through rebellion that he had, that he instigated, that he was able to be victorious, and that the Moabite king stood above the king of King of Israel. Okay? So it's basically written from his point of view. There are a couple of things that are very interesting with regard to this. You'll notice in the quote, it refers by name to Omri and refers to his son. So the first thing, I am Mesha, which is the very beginning of the quote. And that I am Mesha corroborates that there was a king by the name of Mesha that was king of Moab, just as found there in 2 Kings chapter 3. A later part of that quote is that Omri was king of Israel and oppressed Moab during many days, and Chemosh was angry with his aggression. So basically, Omri and his house made Chemosh, the god, angry by the oppression. You'll notice his son succeeded him, and he also said, I will oppress Moab. And so the oppression continued during the time of the son of Omri, who we know from the Old Testament scriptures is indeed Ahab. Okay? Now, I want to read a couple of quotes. I didn't put them up on the board. Another couple of quotes. Again, I've already referred to the possible reference to the house of David. I want to read a little bit about this. This particular quote is taken from Wikipedia. It said, "This section, which is at the bottom of the stone, is badly damaged but appears to tell of Mishah's reconquest of the southern lands of Moab, just as the earlier part dealt with victories in the north. Line 31 says that he captured Horonim from someone who was occupying it. Just who the occupants were is unclear. The legible letters are BTWD. And there was at least one letter in between the BT and the WD that's not, you can't read. Okay? So one particular scholar, his name is Andre Lemaire, has reconstructed this as BTDWD, which would indicate House of David, meaning Judah. It's not universally accepted, but there are many who believe that that's the case. Someone else reads it BTDWDH, which would be the House of Deodah. So, if Lamar is correct in his interpretation, then that would be a reference to the House of David. This would be the first extra-biblical reference to the House of David. In other words, the first or earliest reference to David's house outside of the Bible itself. Okay? Now, the second quote is a reference to Jehovah itself. So, here we have, again, an extra-biblical reference to the God of the Jews, and that his name was Jehovah, or Yahweh in the Hebrew. And so, as a part of this quote, as you go down in the quote on the Moabite stone, it says, "Chemosh said to me, 'Go take Nebo against Israel,' and I went in the night, and I fought against it from the break of day till noon, and I took it, and I killed in all 7,000 men, but I did not kill the women and maidens, for I devoted them to Ashtar-Chemosh. And I took from it the vessels of Jehovah and offered them before Chemosh." So again, this is an indication that he was victorious and he took the implements that would have been utilized in worship, or in his view, in worship to Jehovah God, and that he offered that as a sacrifice to his God, the Moabite God, Chemosh. Okay? So again, there are some corroborations that are found here concerning the name Yahweh or Jehovah as used as being the name of the king of Israel, of the existence of Misha, existence of Omri, existence of Ahab, and possibly an extra-biblical reference to the house of David that is found in this stone that was, what was the date that we get for that? A30 B.C. That's a very old stone. This is called the Moabite stone, or the Misha Stele, or Stele. I don't know how you pronounce that word either. I'm going to have to be a little more careful about pronunciations. I read it, I don't have to pronounce it. And then I come out here and I have to pronounce it. I don't know how to do it because I read it myself. Okay, anybody comments, questions about that particular example again? Yes, Kyle?
The statue of the stone. Uh-huh. Was there knowledge of the people, and knowledge about the object that they were statue, or what was the reason?
Well, you know, I didn't read enough on the background, or at least the particular article I was reading didn't have background about this, but I'll just kind of speak in generalities, what you see quite often. When you're talking about Bible archaeology, you have the same problems back in the 1800s when this was discovered as you have today with regard to Christians versus Muslims, first of all. Again, take as an example with regard to Mount Ararat, which is believed to be in the country of Turkey. And so you have individuals who are believers in the Bible, whether they be Jews or whether they be those who refer to themselves as Christians, that they want to go. And they've got money and they've got a willingness to go to Mount Ararat and find the Noah's Ark. And if Mount Ararat was in the middle of the United States of America, every square inch of that mountain would have been scouted by this time. Satellite imagery, everything, you know, it'd all been there. And we'd know exactly what's on and what's not on it. But in Turkey, they don't want to let Jews or Christians go up Mount Ararat. And so it's very, very difficult to get visas. It's, when they limit the time in which the expedition can be up on the mountain, and extreme limitations at the place on who can go and those kinds of things. And you find this quite often with regard to all of these discoveries. And, you know, with regard to, we'll be talking as we go on, we'll be talking about various manuscripts, for example, with regard to the textual criticism with regard to how we got the Bible and such. And you'll find that you know, a lot of these manuscripts are in some Catholic monastery up on top of a hill. And I mentioned before that there were certain, I don't remember if it was Vaticanus or Sinaiticus manuscripts, but a few of the leaves were actually being ripped out and burned, used as kindling to start fire. And when the individual saw that and recognized what it was, he said, stop it, you know, because they had no awareness of the significance of the fire. The Dead Sea Scrolls, the same kind of thing. Not only that, but you'll also have treasure seekers. So you have archaeologists that will come in and they'll make a discovery. And then they've got to go home and raise some more money to come back. And by the time they get back, you've got the equivalent of grave robbers that have come in and basically destroyed the site and took the antiquities and are selling them on the black market. And the significance of the Moabite stone being found in situ in its place is a rather significant thing, because so often with regard to antiquities, it's very difficult to give the provenance of any particular item because of the fact that these individuals who have no training and no respect for it, they just want money on the black market. They come and steal the things, or they get there before the archaeologists do, and that kind of stuff. So there are always problems. And the interesting thing I'm finding when I study these things is how many interesting stories there are about it. So what I would assume in this regard is that the villagers in that area where the Moabite stone was found were very much resentful of the intrusion of the Europeans in that area, and were enraged for whatever reason, I don't know. But they did, again, they smashed the stone in that particular case. But anyway, it's an interesting, it's a good question. I just don't know that none of the material that I studied in preparation for this, did they ascribe the motivations of villagers as to why they would do it, or whether they had any understanding of the significance of it. I mean, it was obviously a significant discovery because it was often obviously an ancient artifact. But it took some period of time to get it out of the ground, to look at it, to analyze it, and to translate it, and to know what it was that they had. All right. Anybody have questions, comments about that particular artifact? All right. So we are going to cover some things fairly quickly. The next thing I want to talk about is referred to as the Cyrus cylinder. Now, this particular cylinder does not specifically mention the Jews by name, but there is a point that I want to make. If you'll go with me over to the book of Ezra. Book of Ezra in the first chapter. And by the way, if you have your book open, I've got another typo. I have, for some reason, I've typed in Ezra chapter 11, verses 1 through 11, instead of Ezra the first chapter, verses 1 through 11. And since there are only 10 chapters in Ezra, I know for a fact that that's a mistake. It's supposed to be Ezra chapter 1, verses 1 through 11. The Cyrus cylinder, Cyrus, king of Persia. This is another little bitty thing. In fact, I'll just go forward to the next. You can see a picture of someone holding the and it being photographed from behind. There, you see his hands. So you can see about the size of the clay prism, not prism, the clay cylinder there. So it's baked clay, and it is about 9 inches long, and at its largest circumference, there in the middle, it tapers toward the end. It's about 4 inches. So this particular cylinder was created in about 539 BC. Again, with regard to the style of the writing, the time of the events, the proclamation, first person with regard to Cyrus himself and what he has to say about that. This particular one was discovered by an Assyro-British archaeologist. His name was Hormuzd Rassam. And Hormuzd Rassam, discovering it in 1879. He was actually an assistant of a British archaeologist, get his name, and he remained after his boss went back, and they were kind of in an extended program of excavations in Mesopotamia, around the city of Babylon. So it's in Mesopotamia, the city of Babylon, and of course Cyrus is the king of Persia that followed after the overturning of, or the defeat of, the Babylonian Empire. So we'll remember that the Jews had been taken away into Babylonian captivity by King Nebuchadnezzar. And after a period of time, and you'll remember that the prophet Daniel, in his life, as a young man, was taken into Babylonian captivity, and then he served as an advisor to not only the Babylonian kings, but also the Medo-Persian kings. And so Cyrus, king of Persia, he's referenced in Ezra, the first chapter. And I want you to notice, if you'll read with me in Ezra chapter 11, chapter 1, the first 11 verses, what is said here. This is a detailing of the beneficent attitude, the kindness of the king toward the people of Israel. Now again, remember the philosophies, if you will, of the empire. The Babylonians, they always took the people that they conquered and took them out of their land. They dispossessed them. Their idea was it's going to be easier to keep them under control if you basically subjugate them, you remove them, you take them to a strange place, you destroy their leaders and their temples and all those kinds of things. And as a displaced people, they're going to basically have broken spirit. Well, the Persians had the idea, or at least Cyrus did, that the best thing would do would be to have them in their lands, keep them happy, because a happy people will be a people that will be willing to be under your rule. And so what is referenced in the cylinder, and you'll notice the quote at the bottom, this is what Cyrus, and he's as a part of this quote, he talks about, he extols himself, I, the great King Cyrus, as he begins this particular scroll, or this particular cylinder. The quote that's under consideration has reference to the repatriation of peoples. There is not an explicit reference to the Jews on the cylinder, but what was his basic pattern and policy with regard to how he treated those who had been subjugated. So he said, concerning those who were in Babylon, he said, I returned the images of the gods. So these wasn't just the Jews, there were a bunch of different peoples that had been subjugated by the Babylonians. So I returned the images of the gods who had resided there in Babylon to their places. Now, Babylon is in quotation, he's talking about the Babylonian captivity. So I returned the images of the gods who had resided there to their places. So he allowed the images, the idols, to be returned from whence they came. And I let them dwell in their eternal abodes. I gathered all their inhabitants and returned them to their dwellings. So this was the policy of Cyrus, as proclaimed by Cyrus himself, as discovered with regard to this particular cylinder. Now how does that corroborate the biblical account? Well, there in Ezra, the first chapter, we are told in the first year, Cyrus, king of Persia, the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah might be fulfilled. The Lord stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, so that he made a proclamation throughout all his kingdom and also put it in writing, saying, thus says Cyrus, king of Persia, all the kingdoms of the earth the Lord God of heaven has given me. He has commanded me to build him a house at Jerusalem, which is in Judah. Who is among you of all his people? May his God be with him. And let him go up to Jerusalem, which is in Judah, and build the house of the Lord, God of Israel. He is God, which is in Jerusalem. And whoever is left in any place where he dwells, let the men of his place help him with silver and gold, with goods and livestock, besides the freewill offerings for the house of God, which is in Jerusalem. The heads of the fathers, houses of Judah and Benjamin, the priests of the Levites, with all those whose spirits God had moved, arose to go up and build the house of the Lord, which is in Jerusalem. All of those who were around them encouraged them with articles of silver and gold, with goods and livestock, with precious things, besides all that was willingly offered. King Cyrus also brought out the articles of the house of the Lord, which Nebuchadnezzar had taken from Jerusalem, and put in the temple of his gods. And Cyrus, king of Persia, brought them out by the hand of Mithridat, the treasurer, counted them out to Sheshbazzar, the prince of Judah, and this is the number of them: 30 gold platters, 1,000 silver platters, 29 knives, 30 gold basins, 410 silver basins in similar kind, 1,000 other articles. All the articles of gold and silver were 5,400. All these Sheshbazzar took with the captives who were brought from Babylon to Jerusalem. Now this was the return of the remnant from exile at the behest of Cyrus. It is something that Cyrus allowed. And he also, as indicated again in the cylinder, it was his policy to allow the religious artifacts and those possessions of the people to return with the people to their land. So, again, we've got a cooperation. Now, again, what you have, again, is, as you look at these things, obvious differences between the point of view that's found in Scripture with regard to what happened and then the point of view of the individuals that supply the extra biblical relics that we're talking about here. But even in the midst of those different points of views and often competing ideas as to who won, who didn't, and that kind of thing, you have details that corroborate the validity of the text with regard to names, with regard to persons, with regard to occasions, with regard to policies. All of those kinds of things are corroborated. Now, again, the examples of this are manifold. The next one, we don't have time, of course, to get into it. The next time, next one we're talking about is the New Testament one with regard to the existence of Pontius Pilate, the prelate in Judea. And we have a couple of others beyond that. We don't have time. It's not our intent to exhaust it. We couldn't do it. But there are any number of archaeological discoveries. Now, I'm just going to make one more point, and we'll draw this to a close. What you have is the corroboration of details. Not every aspect of the Old Testament is corroborated by any means. And the reason for this is that there is either archaeological relics that have not yet been discovered or uncovered, or perhaps are sitting in a back room somewhere that we don't know about, or else they simply do not exist. It would be ridiculous for us to assume that every single detail, every single name, every single group, every single decade, every single thing that's mentioned in the Bible would have an archaeological corroboration. But what we find as a pattern is that the Bible, the Old Testament, is, and the New Testament as well, are accurate historically. And that there are, whenever recovery is made for these kinds of relics, consistently the cooperation of the biblical account and the details and the people and the places and the nations and all of those kinds of things. And so I will emphasize one more time as we continue in this, and we'll have at least one more week of this, is that a lack of corroboration is not evidence against the reality or the factual nature of the biblical account. All that simply means is that there is no corroboration. You cannot argue from the negative. You cannot say, since there is no corroboration, it didn't exist. And Pilate's going to be a good example of that. Until 1961, I'm jumping the gun a little bit here, but until 1961, most historians didn't believe that there was such a man by the name of Pontius Pilate. Until 1961, because the only place that there was any indication of a man by the name of Pontius Pilate was in the New Testament. It was uncorroborated. But then a discovery in 61 changed that. So that's just an example of what we're talking about. Appreciate very much everyone's kind attention. I know I'm doing a lot of the lecturing. When we get past this part and some of the other things, we'll have time for more discussion. But we'll pick up there next week.